WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest Eric Lipton has been reporting for the New York Times on how the crisis in New Orleans was deepened by the breakdown in communication between the regional authorities and the federal government. Lipton is a national correspondent for the New York Times who covers homeland security issues. He's also the author of the book City in the Sky, The Rise and Fall of the World Trade Center. Earlier today, we phoned him in Baton Rouge, where the New Orleans city government and the federal government have set up offices. Yesterday, when Michael Brown resigned as the head of FEMA, he said, "We're not a first responder agency. We're there to coordinate and help people prepare and coordinate in times of disaster. And so if the country wants us to be more, then we should have a great public policy debate." Now, is that true that FEMA is now considered a first responder? And if that is true, has that always been the case, or is this a change under the Bush administration?
Historically, FEMA has been there to support local and state governments in the midst of disasters. They, you know, providing food, water, emergency relief. But during the Bush administration, there's been a stated policy that they want the states to play an even greater role in handling these disasters on their own. The first director of FEMA under President Bush testified to Congress in 2001 that he felt that some of this assistance had become almost an entitlement, and that perhaps the federal government should be asking the states to play a greater role.
Now, Michael Brown, who resigned yesterday, came under a lot of criticism for the way he handled the hurricane and also for not having much disaster experience. Now, he apparently wasn't the only person at FEMA who didn't have a lot of experience in emergency response. The union that represents FEMA employees wrote to Congress in June of 2004 complaining that, quote, seasoned staff members are being pushed aside to make room for inexperienced novices and contractors. What do you know about that complaint?
Well, if you look at the top ranks of FEMA employees, you have Patrick Rohde, who's the chief of staff, who was basically an advance man for the Bush campaign. You have Scott Morris, who's a deputy chief of staff, who'd worked as a media strategist for President Bush during his primary and also in the Bush-Cheney campaign. So, I mean, it's hard to argue that some of the top people at an agency that's all about emergency response, you know, that they're basically politicos, and, they did not have a great deal of experience in dealing with tornadoes, hurricanes, earthquakes.
Now, your article said that because under the Bush administration, FEMA redefined its role as being subordinate to state and local governments in offering assistance, that meant that with Katrina, the agency most experienced in dealing with disasters and with access to the greatest resources, followed rather than led. How do you think that affected the coordination between state, city, and the federal government?
I think that the single biggest failure in the aftermath of Katrina was the inability of the state, local, and federal government to be able to commandeer enough buses to get people out of the Superdome and the convention center quickly. And for FEMA executives, in defending the time it took them to get the buses there, starting Wednesday night, really in Thursday and Friday in big numbers, said, well, we were not asked to help with buses until Wednesday. But, I mean, if you see tens of thousands of people packed into a stadium who are, you know, some of whom are already dying from, you know, the heat and the lack of sufficient food and water, wouldn't you already be requisitioning buses and sending them in? The FEMA, you know, they felt as if they needed to be have a request before they actually participated in the process of lining up those buses.
But why wouldn't the state or city have made such an obvious request?
Well, again, I mean, the state has some fell down here as well. The state, first of all, should have been able to essentially push a button and line up hundreds of buses if they knew that they were going to use the Superdome as a place to assemble that many people. But they didn't have a plan in place for how they were going to arrange for all those buses to evacuate the Superdome. So therefore, they were desperately calling around to all the parishes in Louisiana trying to convince the local officials to send in their school buses. And once you had the law and order breakdown, the parish officials were hesitant to allow their bus drivers to go into the chaos. And so the state initially tried to do it on its own and then desperately went to FEMA. And as a result, you basically had 3 days of people cooking in the Superdome and in the convention center and some of them dying.
Have you gotten a sense of what happened behind the scenes in Washington, what the debate was like within the Bush administration and within FEMA about what the role of FEMA should be?
I think, you know, after this whole thing starts to unfold, as of Tuesday when the city is flooded, the big question in Washington was whether or not the federal government should essentially federalize the rescue effort and whether or not they should send in active duty troops immediately, take over the National Guard troops that were under control of Governor Blanco in Louisiana, and essentially make it a federal response. And there was a debate within the White House as to whether or not that was an appropriate act. And ultimately, they decided that they were not going to do that. And as a result, there was a slowdown in the delivery of federal troops.
You read that the White House actually considered sending active duty troops to impose order, but that the Pentagon didn't want to do that. What was that disagreement or debate like? What was it about?
Well, it goes back to a law that's been on the books for over 100 years that prohibits the use of active duty federal troops in a law enforcement role inside the United States. And the only time that can occur is if the president declares essentially a state of emergency and federalizes the National Guard troops and then can send in active duty troops to act as almost police officers. The last time that happened was during the Rodney King riots in Los Angeles. But the White House was reluctant to do that, and the Pentagon was also reluctant to get its active duty troops in the midst of a law enforcement role. But the governor of Louisiana did not want to let the federal government control her National Guard troops. So this debate was going on for a couple of days, and as a result, the delivery of active duty troops was slowed.
Do you understand why the governor wanted to control the National Guard troops?
Well, the governor says that she did not actually hear this request until Friday evening, after she felt they had actually taken care of the worst of the looting and the violence. And at that point, she didn't understand why the Bush administration would want to take control of her National Guard troops. And she and her commanding general felt that they were in the best position to know how to deploy the available National Guard resources. And essentially, they were running the show, and they wanted to continue to run the show. They felt that they welcomed active duty troops to assist them, but they did not want to hand over control. I think that historically governors have been reluctant to allow the federal government to assume control of their own National Guard troops. It's a matter of pride. It's also a sense that they better understand where the troops should be deployed and what the needs are in their own state.
Now, Louisiana and Mississippi at the time of the hurricane each had about 3,000 National Guard troops deployed in Iraq. How did the troops deployed in Iraq and the equipment that from the National Guard in Iraq, how do you think that affected the ability of New Orleans to respond to the hurricane?
Well, ultimately, Louisiana was able to pre-position about 4,000 troops prior to the arrival of Katrina. Now, I mean, the governor herself said, if they had another 3,000 troops, that would have made a difference. Exactly how this would have played out differently is impossible to predict, but, that's almost twice as many troops. You could have had, say 4,000 focusing on rescue and a couple thousand focusing on law and order. So, I mean, it's hard to really replay it and to see exactly, whether or not there would have been the chaos that there was, whether or not the rescues would have gone quicker, whether or not those people would, 43 people would have died in the hospital. But clearly there would have been more National Guard resources to speed the evacuation and to prevent the kind of lawlessness that occurred.
What were some of the things that FEMA tried to do but that were either delayed or misplaced or went wrong in some way?
Well, for example, they have 28 urban search and rescue teams that are positioned in locations around the United States. They're basically fire departments that have specially trained teams. They only sent 7 of them to the region in advance of Katrina. And, that's more than, in fact, they almost ever send or perhaps ever sent before. But the warning that was issued on Sunday by the National Weather Service as Katrina was approaching New Orleans really was terrifying. I mean, it was, they were expecting a city that really was going to be wiped out. And not only did they only send 7 of the 28 teams, but it took some of these teams a couple of days to get into the proper locations. And so FEMA had trouble getting its resources into the city of New Orleans into some of these parishes that were most hard hit, and it really slowed down their capacity to help the people that were most in need.
My guest is New York Times reporter Eric Lipton. He's joining us from Baton Rouge. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Joining us from Baton Rouge is Eric Lipton. He's a national correspondent for the New York Times and covers homeland security issues. FEMA stopped some supplies from coming in. What can you tell us about that?
I think that it's hard to know exactly. One of the things I learned during the world and the aftermath of the World Trade Center was that there were so many offers of assistance coming in that it's hard for, you know, a federal agency like FEMA to know when to accept and not to accept those kinds of things, because what they have to do is focus on what they know they can deliver. So there clearly were many things that were offered to FEMA, to the federal government, in the days immediately following Katrina's arrival, and some things that clearly would have helped that they turned down. There was an ambulance company that was willing in one of the parishes to help evacuate and provide medical assistance that FEMA was not, you know, taking them up on their offer. New Mexico was offering to send in National Guard very quickly, and they did not. They were not allowed to move in immediately. And Amtrak apparently was ready to start running trains, we're told, but they were not allowed to for several days. So, but again, it's hard. You'd have to dissect each one of those individually to really know how ready were each one of these parties to deliver the services, and did FEMA end up costing lives or just preventing a service that couldn't actually have helped? And I don't know the answer to that right now.
You write that hundreds of firefighters who responded to a nationwide call for help were held up for 2 days in Atlanta by FEMA before getting to New Orleans, and they were held up for a couple of days of training on community relations and sexual harassment. Do you know why that was done?
FEMA says that these firefighters were going to go into New Orleans and other damaged areas to serve as community relations officers and not as rescue personnel. And so therefore, they felt it was appropriate to give them this sensitivity training. It really infuriated the firefighters who were, you know, desperate to try to help in any way. And, you know, and then you have, you know, hundreds of thousands of people who are angry because of their inability to reach FEMA and to register for assistance. So it's hard to understand why they thought in such a, you know, obvious crisis that it was appropriate to do that kind of, you know, sitting people down for days before they really got in and were helping out.
You write that the leaders in Louisiana were so overwhelmed by the scale of the storm that they were not only unable to manage the crisis, they were not always exactly sure what they needed. How specifically was the state or the city supposed to ask for help?
Well, one of the most important lessons from September 11th was the need to have an extremely redundant communication system so that, you know, almost no matter what happens, you're able to the leaders are able to talk to the first responders on the front line. That completely failed here in Katrina, and the governor and the state officials were not able to reach the mayor of New Orleans, the president of Jefferson Parish, the next largest jurisdiction down here, and so they didn't know what the needs were, and so they weren't able to ask FEMA, said to tell them, well, we've got, you know, 5,000 people in this neighborhood, we've got 10,000 people there, we need medical assistance here. And at one point, the governor actually went into Jefferson Parish on two occasions to try to find the president of Jefferson Parish, just to find out what his needs were, and she couldn't find him. To think that the governor felt that she should take the time to do that and ultimately was unsuccessful is an expression of the kind of communications breakdowns that occurred.
At the start of Katrina, you were covering the story from Washington, and then you moved to Baton Rouge and were covering it from there. Does the story look completely different when you're trying to see it from the eyes of the federal government and FEMA than how it looks when you actually move to Louisiana and start talking to, you know, local and state officials?
I think the thing that you appreciate when you're on the ground here is just the scale of this catastrophe. I mean, I flew into Jackson, Mississippi because I couldn't get a flight into Baton Rouge, and then I drove down, you know, through Mississippi into Louisiana. I mean, even in Jackson, it's you know, a couple hundred miles inland. I mean, it, just as you come out of the airport, you're seeing trees down, signs down, damage. And, I mean, as the federal government says, you know, this is something like 90,000 square miles of devastation, you know, are at least damage and complete devastation along the coast. And I think that when you see it, you begin to appreciate just how enormous the challenge was here and why, you know, logistically speaking, you know, even in a country as rich and powerful and, you know, as the United States, immediately responding to this as comprehensively as the American public would like and as comprehensively as the people who desperately need wanted was going to be very hard. And I think it's easier to see that when you're on the ground here and you just drive through mile and mile of area of damage.
Now, you're staying in Baton Rouge. Would you set the scene for us there and tell us how Baton Rouge has been changed?
The biggest difference here in Baton Rouge is just how overwhelmed it is. The city's population has been perhaps doubled or tripled. Even just getting, you know, down the street here is you have to fight. There's so much traffic. The city is, you know, the services, the roads, and everything else is just packed with people as this has become a refugee town for some of the residents of New Orleans and many of the businesses. So, I mean, it's strange because here you are in a city that everything is operating and the damage is, there are trees that are down, but the damage is quite curtailed. And just next door, you know, literally, is New Orleans where the devastation is overwhelming. So, you know it's happened, but at the same time, there's a real distance between the two worlds.
Eric, you co-wrote a book a few years ago about the World Trade Center, about how it was built and how it was destroyed by terrorist attack. Of course, Sunday was the anniversary of that attack, and you were covering the catastrophe in New Orleans. And I'm just wondering what it's been like these past few days to be thinking about the anniversary of September 11th and at the same time to be in the middle of covering, you know, a natural disaster.
I think one of the things that I appreciate is you know the sense of the overwhelming sense of catastrophe that we all had in New York on September 11th and the question as to whether or not we could ever return to normal and the sense that this was such a war zone in Lower Manhattan where I lived not far from the World Trade Center and you know 4 years out it's hard to remember just how overwhelmed we were, and I think that's something here that's important to keep in mind. Even you know, with a city like New Orleans that is now largely empty to people and completely flooded, that look at where New York is at now and its capacity to sort of rise from such a catastrophe, and I don't know. I mean, it's just I think the thing that I reflected upon is just resilience. And how people are able to overcome even things that seem impossible.
You know, in addition to writing about the World Trade Center and now covering the hurricane, you were also in Banda Aceh after the tsunami. So you've been covering a lot of disasters in the past few years. And is that making you feel either any more vulnerable or any more toughened, you know, seeing all of this human suffering and disaster?
I think it's made me more humble and also given me, you know, a greater sense of just how finite, you know, life is and how, you know, how much it has to do with sort of where you're standing and whether or not you're lucky. I mean, thinking about, for example, people standing on the 78th floor at the World Trade Center, the Sky Lobby where in the South Tower where the airplane was the bottom floor that the airplane impacted, and talking to, you know, one woman who was standing next to another man and she survived and the guy standing right next to her was killed in the impact. And you know, it's quirks of fate, I think, sometimes that there's a difference between who lives and who dies. And I just have seen that over and over again now at the World Trade Center. In Indonesia, you know, the one member of the family that's still alive and every other member of their family is dead. And here, the difference between life and death is it's hard to understand. But it's something that I think it consumes people. They want to know that answer, and I'm not able to give them. But it's something that people want to understand why that is.
Eric Lipton, thank you very much for talking with us.
Sure. Thank you.
Eric Lipton recorded earlier today from Baton Rouge. He's a national correspondent for the New York Times and covers homeland security issues.